My thanks to the, I believe I'm correct, the Secretary General here of this distinguished assemblage. May I first of all thank you for inviting me, secondly, for the applause that has awakened me. They say there are two kinds of people, daytime people and nighttime people. And I confess that I'm much more alert somewhere after 9 o'clock in the evening rather than 9 o'clock in the morning. I want to compliment the Georgetown University International Relations Club for their sponsorship of this Model United Nations Assembly, but more significantly for the tremendous educational job that they've been doing these past years in the field of international relations far beyond the confines of that great university. I'm reminded, though, when I think of Georgetown, of the time that Bob Hope gave the commencement address over there. And he looked out over the graduating class and he said, to all of you graduates who are about to go out in the world, my advice is, don't go. Now, obviously the Georgetown University graduates didn't listen to that advice, and I'm pleased, because they've been out in the world and they've been doing a good job. I come to you today as a friend of your endeavor. I have a choice to make this weekend as to whether or not I would return home to my family out in Minnesota and my constituents, or whether I would stay here, first for the presidential classroom group which I visited with, and secondly for this group, in order to share with you some thoughts and, more importantly, to observe you in action and to get some inspiration and uplift from you. I'm glad I made the decision that I did. I sat over here in the corner for a while and listened to the presentations, the arguments made on resolution, and I believe I'm in a position to be somewhat of a judge as to the quality of your work. I served as a delegate for the United States of America and the United Nations in 1956 and 1957. I've served as a delegate representing this country, our country, at UNESCO. I've served as an observer for the United Nations Disarmament Commission on several occasions. I have traveled to visit most of the great UN international organizations, watching them at work, observing the developments under the programs of the UN. So I come to you with some background of interest and experience. I was privileged to represent our Congress at the 10th anniversary of the United Nations. I had hoped at one time, about 2 years ago, to be able to represent our country at the 25th anniversary of the United Nations. So I settled for this, and I think maybe I got the best of the deal. I'm speaking to an audience that has come into what I call the age of responsibility. And let me, for a moment, stress what I mean. By a vote of the Congress and the decision of the Supreme Court, and now by the vote of many state legislatures or constitutional amendments in state constitutions, young Americans, frequently termed adolescents or youth, have now become voting citizens. They are in their maturity, and with that privilege of the right to exercise the right to vote comes tremendous power. And with power, as I hope you've learned in this Model UN, comes a full measure of responsibility. I want to impress upon you the importance of the decisions that have been made in recent months and years relating to young men and women. We've had great arguments in this country about our system, as we always do. As a matter of fact, it is this ferment of controversy and argument, commonly called dissent, that has made for our growth. Dissent with destruction inevitably brings repression and reaction, but dissent in honest debate and dialogue can bring truly constructive change and positive progress. Now you have the opportunity, indeed now you have the responsibility. In the next few months, in the year of 1972, which is a year of great decision, for you to make a final determining decision as to the development of this country. Every presidential election is close. With few exceptions, there will be 11.5 million new voters, eligible voters if you're registered, and hopefully constructive voters if you're informed, and hopefully active voters if you will just get out and vote in the year 1972, not merely for president and vice president, but in many states and hopefully in all, for governors and legislators, for public servants of many different kinds. Now that's a powerful force. In the last presidential election, a change of 70,000 votes out of 72 million would have changed the results of the election. And had that been the case, we would not be meeting in the Shoreham Hotel. We'd be meeting in the East Room of the White House right now. Exposure on the part of public officials to you and you to them, and particularly in the highest councils of our country. It's good for us. Now you are going to make a great decision, and that's why this conference that you're holding, this Model UN, is so important. Because your country and my country, the United States of America, was one of the, well, surely was the inspirational force, the driving force behind the creation of the United Nations, but we haven't been the sustaining force. Only within a few blocks of where we are now, in this great capital city, was held the Dumbarton Oaks Conference, which laid the basic principles for the formulation of the UN. And might I say that in the agony of war, in the unbelievable destruction of World War II, even as men were dying and nations being pulverized, there were men in high place in the great governments of the Allied nations that were thinking about how they might prevent any such Holocaust again. High standards and high goals were established. High standards and high goals that came out of the agony of war and the memory of the failure of the League of Nations and the immoral position of the United States, who maintained an attitude of isolationism. Now, I must say to this young, distinguished assemblage that never again must this country withdraw from its responsibilities of constructive service and participation in international affairs. This is a world community. If the space age has taught us nothing else, it has taught us how small this space satellite called Earth really is, and how we are all on it together, and there is no escape, that we either will live together or die together. We'll either move forward together or we will disintegrate together. And if there is a message that has come to us, it is in our time that we are the family of man, and that the family of man must learn how to live in the household that is ours, called Earth. Now, I have loaded down here from my years of experience in the Congress. I served for several years as chairman of the International Relations Subcommittee of the United States Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, attending UN sessions, knowing the leaders of the UN, Trygve Lie, Dag Hammarskjöld, the great Ralph Bunche, one of the truly great Americans, and by the way, sending a message of good wishes and goodwill. He is a man that is seriously ill at the time, losing his sight, but even as he loses his physical sight, he has a clearer vision of what this world ought to be than many people who have 20/20 physical vision. Troubles, we ought to remind ourselves of what the signatories to the United Nations pledged and promised. Because a pledge and a promise, while often forgotten, can be a living memory to activate people to performance. They pledge themselves to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties can be maintained, and promote social progress and better standards of life. Those are the great charges, the great pledges of the Charter of the UN, so often violated. But I must remind you that, like most things, it's the commitments that one makes that compels one to try to do better. And as you gather here, don't just be concerned about the procedures of the UN. Be deeply committed to its purposes and its principles. Insist, for example, in our own country, as a member of the family of nations, try to live up to the pledges that we made as a signatory to the UN. Reaffirm faith, for example, in fundamental human rights. If there's any one thing that the young generation of America of 1971 ought to pledge itself to and can do, it is to abolish every trace by personal living, by your own habits, by your words and by your deeds, to abolish from the entire social, economic structure of America every form of racism and discrimination and segregation. That's what we mean by that. Get your own standards and have them become a part of the amalgam of what we call our country, its way of life, its mores. Now let me speak very frankly to you about another matter. The member nations who signed that original charter promised to practice tolerance and live together in peace, to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, to ensure that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples. Boiled down to simple language, this means working to produce the conditions that are conducive to peace. Those who signed that charter were not so foolish or naive as to believe that peace comes for the wishing, nor does it come by the stroke of a pen or the signing of a treaty. The men and the women who helped conceive the United Nations and who had dedicated a lifetime to it know that peace is the end product of conditions that are conducive to peace. And everything that's been said here, reaffirming faith and human rights, promoting social progress and better standards of life, all of these things are the seedbed, the soil in which the precious flower of peace can grow and survive. And it's quite obvious that this garden of peace that we've looked for and longed for is filled with weeds of fear and hate, of war and destruction. But the flower is not yet dead. And indeed, what I am saying to you is that it is up to each generation in its own way, without acrimony and without bitterness towards another, to try to find some way to make a contribution to a more wholesome and healthy social environment that is conducive to peace. Now, if we were to draw up a scorecard on the UN and its performance relating to these defined goals, I guess the final score would not place any single nation or group of nations in the winner's box. There is not an abundance of evidence, is there, to show that we've even come close to attaining the noble aims and the high hopes that were ascribed to the United Nations when it was founded out of the ashes of World War II. And as we look at the UN in its 25th year, and in the terms of history, that is but a fleeting second. It's nothing. We can therefore not go overboard in our rejoicing about what has been achieved. But I can say this, the UN is still alive. It continues to grow. It is at least alive in terms of its functions. And what it needs most of us, most from us, and needs most of all, is the added spirit, commitment, and the structural flexibility that's capable of coping with today's demands of the international society. And that shot of political adrenaline or spiritual adrenaline must come from the members themselves, and especially from the United States, who is the founding father, and whose influence can be the necessary catalyst for strengthening the entire network of international organizations. You see, the building of peace is like the construction of a great cathedral. It isn't done by one or even one generation. It requires the master plan of a great architect, to be sure, but the endless dedication and work of generations yet unborn. I've often thought, as I visited in capitals and great cities around the world, and see these magnificent symbols of spirit that we call cathedrals, how long it took, how much sacrifice went into it, and yet there was a great vision, a great dream. And finally, in some areas at least, after many years of toil, the creation was there, an inspiration for those yet to come. So from the vantage point now of hindsight, and you're always smarter looking back than you are looking ahead, you know, I think it's possible to conclude that one reason for the relatively lackluster performance of the UN was that of the high goals and standards that we set for ourselves, which possibly were beyond human proportion. I think there are those that expect too much from the UN and those who expect nothing. Both of them do it a disservice. But if these goals, as I have said, serve on the other hand as a guideline for international behavior, then I say the record is not nearly as grim, nor is the possibility of making substantial advances nearly as remote. I think UN members are more conscious today of reducing their goals to a manageable size than they were at the outset. There is hopefully a greater appreciation in the world today and in our own culture of national differences and a conscious attempt to move forward slowly, even if it is by stops and starts. The great writer John Steinbeck noted man's entire existence is spent as he put it, in moving two steps forward and one step backward. You might call that the progressive shuffle. Just be careful that you don't get one step forward and two steps backwards, which is all too often what happens. But perhaps this moving one step forward, two step forward, and one step backward is the basic design of life. What makes the whole process worthwhile is the excitement and the gratification of actually making progress and maintaining a forward momentum. I don't think, therefore, that we should demand from the United Nations any more than we ask from our own lives. Movement, even if it's in stops and starts, but nevertheless real progress. And I believe that today you can do a great service for the cause of international peace through the United Nations, through international law, by being realistic about it, pointing out that we can make progress, that the millennium maybe is not at hand, that utopia is not within our immediate grasp, but like life itself, we can grow and we can change for the better. You know, the Pope Paul has said that development is the new name for peace. And one area where we really can push ahead is the one that you were debating when I came in here today, in this area of economic and general improvement of the human condition. On the one hand, it means an amount of structural reform so that the UN organizations will be better equipped to handle a much larger volume of technical assistance and pre-investment aid. On the other hand, there must be the necessary leadership to provide the kind of inspiration and uplift necessary for wider, more resolute cooperation. What will defeat us in this undertaking is what Lester Pearson calls the faintness of heart and the narrowness of vision. And I'm afraid that some of us have played with it. What this nation needs today, more than it needs prosperity, is a sense of direction. What young Americans want today is not so much the material blessings as they want hope for a better quality of life. And I believe that this is what this country must offer, because basically we're a young country. And we ought to have the kind of enthusiasm as a nation in our political and social and economic institutions which has been manifest here. A willingness to dare, to try, to lead, to inspire, and be not afraid if at times we fail. Because out of even the failures, we can build new confidence. Therefore, I say it's the United States which must assume this role of leadership. And I sincerely hope that our government, regardless of whom occupies the high positions of cabinet and president, that we will do everything in our power to build a stronger UN, to commit the basic outlines of our foreign policy, not on a unilateral or bilateral basis, but within the structure of international law and within the structure of the United Nations and the commitments that we made. For example, it's high time that this great republic of ours adopted as a singular principle of international behavior, the principle of universality. By that I mean the right of any country, regardless of its form of government or its ideology, to be a member of the United Nations and a participating member of the United Nations. Making the UN a world organization. And even though we may have strong disagreement with actions of countries and ideological philosophy, we are there here. And the reality of the presence of a government or a country or a nation should indicate its inclusion within the UN. We often speak today, for example, of the problem membership of the People's Republic of China. Well, my dear friends, we have played games with this long enough. 850 million people, regardless of their government and how it acts, should not be excluded, at least by the leadership of the United States, from the membership in the United Nations. It doesn't become a United Nations with 1/4 of the human race excluded from its membership. And I happen to believe that as troublesome as it may be, as the People's Republic of China may be as a member, that an isolated China is far more dangerous to the cause of peace and social progress than a People's Republic of China that is integrated and brought within the family of nations. I think the chances for peace are much better in the latter. We no longer can undertake the responsibilities alone of maintaining what is called peace through oftentimes unpeaceful methods. But if the United States is to abandon its role or to set aside its role as a peacekeeper or a policeman, then I submit to this audience of intelligent young men and women that the world in which we live today does not make it possible for there to be no peacekeeping machine. In other words, if we withdraw from it as a unilateral obligation, then it must become a multilateral obligation. And therefore, the wisdom of this nation or the judgment of this nation in terms of international decision should be to find new means and methods of international peacekeeping. And only one organization offers that hope, and that is the United Nations itself. And rather than to be arguing about how we pay for it, which is penny-ante argument, the amount of money involved is so little that it's almost ridiculous that we even debate it. It would seem to me that it would be the highest purpose of this nation, that one of its most important international objectives, to find ways and means through whatever channels we can, assuring that there's some form of international machinery, not dominated by the United States, not dominated by the Soviet Union, but some form of international machinery for international peacekeeping. We may very well be compelled to face up to this in short order if there's to be any peace in the Middle East. And possibly the recent offer of the Soviet Union to engage in peacekeeping in the Middle East with the United States and with others may for the first time give us some effective peacekeeping machinery, once that there can be agreement between Israel and her neighbors on the standards of peace. There's something else. I hope that the United Nations will continue, and I hope that you as individual citizens will stress the importance of the United Nations being the focal point for arms control and disarmament. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, if we pursue in this mad arms race, we will do one of two things. We will either bleed ourselves economically like a running hemorrhage, or we will, by accident, not by premeditation, but by accident, find ourselves in a nuclear holocaust from which there is no escape, total destruction. Strongly about this. I've spent a good deal of time on it. It was my privilege to be a sponsor of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It was my privilege to be the author of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. I spent many years at conferences working towards some progress in the field of arms control. And we are now at one point, oh, we're so close in the conferences in Helsinki and Vienna to some kind of control over strategic nuclear weaponry. And I intend this week, as a matter of fact, after you've left here, to address myself to this, because I have some points of view which are slightly different than those which are coming from the executive branch of government at this time. Now, not that different, but some difference. Surely our United Nations has demonstrated some capability in its treaty on space, prohibiting weapons of mass destruction to be orbited in outer space. And the step further beyond that is international research and exploration in outer space. Surely the United Nations has proven some powers and some of its vitality in the recent Treaty on the Oceans. And might I say that I take some pleasure in this because it was my privilege as the chairman of the Space Council to be in part somewhat responsible for advancing America's position in the Outer Space Treaty. And as chairman of the Marine Sciences Council, we prepared in that council the draft treaty which ultimately became the basis for the United Nations Treaty on the Oceans to prevent weapons of mass destruction being fastened to the floor of the ocean. Small steps, but important steps in peace. Now, undoubtedly, one of the major achievements of the 25th anniversary session to which you've given some attention was the adoption on October 24th of the International Development Strategy for the second United Nations Development Decade, beginning January 1 of this year. The Economic and Social Council, one of the most important organizations of the UN, unanimously adopted a comprehensive strategy document which launched the second development decade. Oh, its standards are high, its aims are maybe beyond accomplishment, but they give a sense of direction. If there's any one thing that disturbs me in our own country today is its lack of planning, the lack of priorities, the lack of ascertainable goals. We seem to be like a wounded animal, running hither and yon, never knowing just where we're going. And I submit that even with our power and wealth, there are some things that can't be done by just wasteful, extravagant use of energy and money. It requires some sense of direction. And thank goodness the United Nations has now at least formulated a strategy for development, a sense of purpose. And one of the key provisions of the document was the recommendation that each economically advanced country, to wit, the United States, Japan, France, Germany, the Soviet Union, and others, should endeavor to provide to developing countries by 1972, and at the latest by 1975, financial assistance of a minimum net amount equivalent to 1% of its gross national product. Now, my friends, are you willing to work for it, or are we just going to say it? We talk about peace dividends on the happy day that this tragic struggle in Vietnam can be ended. Will there be any peace dividends? I was in the Congress in 1954, at the end of the war in Korea. And I was a member of a little small band of senators that tried to do some things for our cities, for our minorities, for our poverty-ridden rural areas, for foreign aid. And I'm here to tell you that once that the expenditure for war was over, all that we could get out of the Congress was a reduction in taxes rather than a commitment to building a more peaceful world and a better quality of life in America. Now, you're going to have something to say about this, and I'm putting it right on the table. You're going to have votes, and I suggest that you start to interrogate people not only on what they have done, but what they will do. Will they help fulfill the commitment of 1% of our gross national product, for example, for economic and technical assistance to the developing nations of the world? Or are we going to permit the gap between the rich and the poor to grow and to grow until there is no hope for reconciliation and war is inevitable? Make up your mind. Now let me give you my final observation. Another equally important point adopted in the strategy statement was that the government's, quote, will intensify national and international efforts to arrest the deterioration of the human environment and to take measures towards its improvement and to promote activities that will help to maintain the ecological balance on which human survival depends. Particular emphasis has been placed, as it should be, on the link between environmental control and economic and social development. Now, this is right on target. all over the world today, at least all through our country, fortunately, there's an awareness of what's happening to this household of ours, our own space satellite on which we are the passengers, what's happening to our environment. A certain amount of work has already been done in this area during the first development decade. Pollution of the seas was one of the earliest environmental problems considered to warrant international action, and an international convention was signed in 1954 in this regard. The Convention of the High Seas calls for future regulation to prevent pollution. The Convention on Fishing and Conservation of the Living Resources of the High Seas stresses the need for international cooperation to prevent the danger of overfishing. And the Convention on the Continental Shelf of 1964 stipulates that the exploitation or the exploration of the continental shelf and natural resources must not result in any unjustifiable interference with the conservation of the living resources of the sea. High purpose, but short on enforcement. This is what we ought to be talking about. Leading the way, enforcement through example, by the way we do things, instead of spewing out our garbage and making the oceans the international garbage pit, instead of having continuously a policy of polluting the seas, and we surely have. These efforts have created the general atmosphere, the UN efforts, for more precise work which must be done in this next decade. I believe that we must act on the global aspects of pollution. We've talked about, you know, that you can't control pollution just in your town or your county or your state. You can't control it in your nation. The pollution that is to be found in the air, in the rivers, and in the oceans is international. I submit to you that pollution is a form of aggression which may be more deadly than military aggression. It's a form of aggression when the soot from English factories turns the snow of Sweden black. It's the form of aggression when the waters of rivers pouring into the Mediterranean, polluted waters, may very well make the Mediterranean a dead sea. How many of you read the feature article last Sunday in the New York Times of the Italian scientists and others who are desperately worried that the beautiful blue Mediterranean may become a totally polluted international body of water? The beautiful blue Danube is a floating sewer. The Rhine River caught on fire. And indeed it did. And all over the world, the same problem is to be found. Why, the explorer, Thor Heyerdahl, sees garbage and oil slicks in mid-ocean. And yet the ocean is international property. Therefore, I submit that it is a form of aggression to permit this to happen. And international aggression under the Charter of the UN requires international action. My second reason is that we must always be on the lookout for turning potential adversity into realistic progress. The ways of political progress are sometimes very strange. The tragedy of the Depression in America brought about tremendous progress. One of the things was Social Security, if nothing else. The tragedy of the war in Vietnam has turned American thought towards, among other things, the massive amounts of money that is directed towards military spending, our over-involvement militarily. And today, as a result of that sort of awakening, military spending is under careful scrutiny and is being reduced. And a total re-examination is coming of the nature and the purpose of American foreign policy. In similar fashion, I believe that the potential ecological crisis, and I think it's more than potential, I think it's actual, may provide mankind with the opportunity to get off the dime and make one small step towards a system of enforceable world law. And here specifically is my proposal. In 1971, this year, it's already very late, The President should convene a special White House conference to prepare the American delegation to the United Nations conference in Stockholm of 1972, so that our delegation can go there in a role of leadership with programs and policies and plans that would be worthy of international consideration. This White House conference should be convened to consider a plan to create, through the United Nations, a body of international law directed towards the protection of the environment. It should all come out, I believe, with the proposal for a UN commission on pollution control to enforce that law. And this commission's first function, once established by the UN, would be to create an international pollution code and quality standards designed to assure a safe environment. The White House conference this year ought to propose guidelines for such standards. Then in 1972, the American delegation to the Stockholm UN Environmental Conference ought to propose the establishment of such a UN commission. Hopefully by 1973, a plan for a commission with a model set of standards can be presented to the UN General Assembly for approval. And the United States should exercise all of its political muscle in the United Nations to establish such a commission. If we'll bend our efforts towards this as much as we've done towards some other things, we might get much done. And we should actively aim our work in the UN to see to it that this new commission be given a rare and crucial commodity in the realm of UN organizations: power and authority. The new UN Pollution Control Commission will be effective only if its charter has teeth in it to enforce the codes of conduct. As a first step, the Commission ought to be given power to impose forms of political and commercial sanctions on nations who violate the pollution codes. And it can be done. Now, it may be difficult, but this is an unprecedented task and undertaking. The issue at stake is not the familiar realm of power politics, which often brings out the worst in every nation. The issue that we're talking about involves the very survival of the species of man. And if what I've read, it involves your survival, I would imagine that men of my age might get through this crisis. But it is a fact that 55 to 60% of the entire population of America at this hour will be alive in the year 2000 if we protect our environment and prohibit ourselves from total destruction by war. It's an attempt, therefore, that I'm proposing to let the species of man live on this beautiful planet created by his maker and his efforts. Now, this issue transcends regional or ideological rivalries. Polluted air covers every nation. Polluted waters will wash the shores of the nations, both communist and capitalist, old and new, rich and poor. Polluted air knows no boundaries. Rivers that flow between nations recognize no sovereignty. The ocean, three-fifths of the Earth's surface, belongs to all of us. And so this effort must be expanded to include the nations that are not now members of the UN. The two Germanys, the two Vietnams, the two Koreas, the People's Republic of China must and should be invited to attend and participate in the Stockholm Conference. These nations are involved in the problem as we are. China has an immense problem of pollution and a serious population problem, and it is attempting to deal with both. We can do nothing but help ourselves if we help the Chinese solve these sorts of problems by international cooperation. Similarly, the Russians now have a major pollution problem, more serious than ours, as do the communist nations of East Europe. Properly approached, I believe that they would all be willing to cooperate in this endeavor, because international agreements that are effective are those that are mutually advantageous. And surely this is mutually advantageous. And because of the gravity of the situation, I believe they would cooperate by putting teeth in this particular United Nations endeavor. Now, I admit that no one knows if such an ambitious, even visionary proposal will bear fruit. But my point is, we must try. We need to take some risks for a better world. We need to even take some risks for peace. We're always willing to take risks